accession number 18730, Reel 7.
Jim Cox, Reel 7. I think there are one or two things that you'd like to go back to that you had forgotten from North Africa days.
Well, only that one now. As I'd spoken about the Yankee getting killed.
But I think you said that you came across a German in hospital at Sukaris.
Ah, yes. In Sukaris, German wounded, German sick, they were mixed up with us. In the next bed to me was a German who I assisted. He was in plaster from his whole body practically, and he couldn't move an inch. And during the night, not many orderlies about, and he would ask me just to touch his leg, which was encased in plaster, and I'd probably only move it half an inch, but danken. It must have been a great relief to him. But we mixed very well. And one day a German came across to me, could speak a bit of English. He said he'd noticed from my designations on my shoulder that I was a Coldstream guard. He said, "You are a Coldstream guard?" I said, "Yes, I am." "Did I know a Captain Wills?" I said, "Yes, he was my company commander until we lost him at Marath." "Ah," he said, "that was the night he had the duty of looking after Captain Wills, who had been very severely wounded, receiving numerous bullet wounds, practically riddled with bullets. And he offered him morphine injection, but he said he refused it. He said, "I got the impression," he said, "that your English old school tie didn't let Captain Wills accept this morphine injection. He didn't want anything from the enemy." But whether that be true or not, I don't know. I know it's come across my mind on several occasions. Captain Wills, I understand, was from the tobacco family. And I often thought that those gentlemen had far more to lose than us ordinary soldiers. They were born into a life of riches and luxury. He could have been hunting, shooting, fishing, enjoying life, but he elected to join the army, and he loses his life at a young age, in a sense. I said, all I had to look forward to when I got back was 5 or 6 days work a day, and pre-war it was up to 12 hours a day sometimes, and probably lots of debts. I think the officers that guided us had far more to lose than we had, but they still put their life at risk.
Now, shall we pick up the narrative where we left it, which was in Austria, and you were talking about the distribution of beer and biscuits to the wounded.
Yeah. I didn't mention, like the nurse rebuking the fella that... I didn't mention that, did I?
Tell me about that.
The same occurred as when the orderly was dishing out food on the hospital train. This chappie behind me shouted out that I was an Englander and could be welcomed into Germany with their beer and biscuits, you see. And she turned around and snapped at him. I couldn't tell what she was saying, but would gather that she was saying, "You may have been in England wounded and would want looking after, you see," and which quietened me down again. But that was twice he had a go. So I said, I used to think, I hope he can't get out of bed, or else I might not wake up one morning. End up with his throat cut. Well, having entered Germany or Austria, all one now, I think. Anyway, we journey on until we come to the town of Rottmünster, I think it was. Rottweiler, Rottmonster, both together. Transferred to an ambulance and taken into a hospital which had been handed over. I think most of it, a good lot of it, was Allied prisoners. And in the wing, I think we were in. I think we had three doctors: an Englishman and a Scotchman, and an Australian. And they looked after, with the help of orderlies, of course, about 200 patients of all nationalities, some Poles we had and all kinds. And they had very little equipment, but anyway, they examined me that night, and I told them about the tablets the Germans had been giving in, the refusal to operate and that kind of thing. And they checked me out and said, yes, I'd had pleurisy. That would be the reason, and the tablets would be M&B tablets. So they said, we can't do anything about that bullet, which I obviously had in the body somewhere, until the pleurisy had cleared up. So we went to bed, and I was bedfast for a number of weeks. Somehow or another, they omitted to designate an orderly for me, and I'd been there, oh, I don't know, 10 days to a fortnight, I think, before one of the doctors, who wasn't my doctor, I'd been allocated the Australian. He was looking after me, a Dr. Prittis. But the Scotchman came in the ward one day. I was in a small room then. There was only four of us in. And he took a look at me and he said, who's your orderly? I said, well, I haven't seen one yet. Good God. So, of course, I had a fair growth of beard and a lot of grime and dirt from when I was fighting. I hadn't had a wash. I mean, the Germans had fed me and tended to my wounds, but they didn't bother to wash me or anything like that. And so I was in a fair filthy state. They sent an orderly down immediately, and how many bowls of water he used that afternoon on me, I don't know. He started by peeling off my undervest and peeled off like a sticky plaster, nearly. And I had no gear, and of course he was very loath. Razor blades, I think they were worth more than gold sovereigns in a prison camp. But anyway, there was one chappy, he said, well, you can have my razor, and I'll let you have one blade. He belonged to Sherwood Foresters, I believe, that kid. And eventually they got down to me. And it was a glorious feeling once they'd got me cleaned up. And I lay in bed for quite some time. And then the pleurisy got worse. And there was we had an American orderly there. Went like a lot of Americans with the name of Hank. And he was a very diabolical fella. And he came in one midday, pushed a bowl of something near my bed, and learned later it was disinfectant stuff, and was going out the door, but he just put his head back in. He said, he's coming to cut you up, and went. So I didn't know what this was, but anyway, eventually Captain Prittis rolled up with a needle, the bigger I've only seen my veterinary surgeon since, with one as big, and he got that entered into this fluid, and he seemed to be, he left the needle in, of course, and screwed the syringe off. How many times he emptied it, I lost count, at about 10, I think, and it was a terrific great syringe.
Which part of your body was it?
That was in the left lung, you see, pleurisy. Fills with fluid between the linings of the lung. And Anyway, he said, well, you've still got to clear that up. We'll leave you a few weeks. The Germans used to allow the British doctors there to use their X-ray. I may be wrong, but whether it was once a fortnight or once in 3 weeks, I can't remember. But anyway, about 3 weeks later when they took me down to X-ray me, and it was a stand-up plate-like, and they three doctors, they were all there, confabbing behind it, and apparently they couldn't even tell which lung I'd had it in. So I'd cleared that up fairly good, and that was without any antibiotics or any medicine of any description. But they hadn't any to give us. I forget to mention the bedpan parade, we called it. There were only two bedpans for these 200 patients. And I could never get any enjoyment out of a bedpan. Never got any relief with it, whatever. Well, the drill was that in the morning, anyone that could get on their feet and collect a bedpan for the chap in the next bed or whatever, they used to go and wait outside the room where the bedpan was, and there got to be a queue probably at its height of about 20 fellas all, and they used to follow this bedpan round the hospital, or the two bedpans, and Roberts, this Sherwood Forester, he used to go for me every morning. I would try, but no joy. And they'd be hammering on the door, and he used to have to give it up in the finish, unused. And this went on for some considerable time. And I think in all, I must have been in there 3 weeks. I was a week on the hospital train, and I was a week in hospital before that. So almost 5 weeks that I never emptied my bowels. But we were, luckily, on nothing much but liquid at the time. Anyway, in the finish, as I got a bit stronger in the legs and such like, my friend Roberts, he said, could you get down to the toilet with my help? I said, well, I may well do. I said, we shall have to do something soon. Strange enough that neither the doctors nor yet the orderlies bothered about this situation, whatever. But Roberts got me out of bed, and down to the toilet we went. He planted me on there and left quick. And that was a great relief. Then time went on, I don't know just how long, but on the left side of my body, an itch one morning, as you get when a wound is increasing, but I'd received the bullet on the right side, right in the waist, and I'm rubbing my left chest on the left side. I thought, good God, here's the bullet. And it had gone right through my body, come between the ribs on that side, and I could literally get hold of it. So my doctor, when he came, Dr. Prittis, he was highly delighted. He said, well, that's not a serious job now, is it? I said, not if it's the only one, no. And incidentally, that had done no permanent damage. I neither spit blood nor suffered anything by pain. Of course it hurt, but it hadn't done any particular damage. How it got through there without doing so, well, it's defied the belief of several doctors since who I've been under. But anyway, came the day when Dr. Prittish said, right, he said, well, let's have that friend of yours out, he said. Be down at the theatre at 2 o'clock. So at 2 o'clock I ambled away down to the theatre, knocked on the door, and there were all three doctors in there, plus a bundle of orderlies, all interested in anything that was going on. Ah, you're the principal guest today. Get on that table. So I said, this shouldn't take long. And I haven't 100% injection, but I don't think you'll feel anything. I said, and the scalpel, the only one we have, he said, I wouldn't like to cut my corns with it. So he said, I've got a razor blade here. He had a safety razor blade. And this is what he set about extracting this bullet out of me with. Every time he cut, particularly when he was trying to cut round the bullet, I could hear it. And my right leg kept jumping up. I was laid on my stomach. And I could not stop it. In the finish, he said, can you feel that? I said, no, but I can hear it every time. I said, I can't stop it jumping up. He said, sit on it, somebody. So, of course, they held it down then. And we're doing fine, till all of a sudden he, damn and blast it. And this razor blade, holding between his thumb and forefinger, had shattered in 1,000 pieces, in the wound, of course. And in what should have been probably a 10-minute operation, lasted about 2 hours. All he could keep saying was, I daren't sew you up, I daren't sew you up, I daren't leave one little fragment of that blade edge in you. He said it would float about in your arteries. And that, of course, I had to live with for a good long while. But nothing came of it, and I'm still here. that, what was that? The winter of 44, wasn't it? Down in southern Germany, there was a lot of snow, and the Red Cross parcels began to get a bit thin. They couldn't get them through in the winter time, and we got down to literally nothing. And the Germans had nothing either. And I think 3 days they came around with a tub of, well, it was boiled red cabbage. And that was all they had to give us. No, sorry, the first thing was Swede. The old Swede. Boiled. And you got the water it was boiled in and all the lot. It was fill belly for a time. But even though chaps were hungry, you found them saying, you can't eat that, they feed that to cows. I said, well, if you don't want yours, I'll have it. And I had some oleo margarine out of an American Red Cross parcel stored by. It was as hard as anything. You couldn't do very little with it, except leave it in this here warm Swede for a while, and it made it quite edible. And so I did fairly well on that, and then we were 3 days on Swede, and the next 3 days we were on the red cabbage. And I think the third day there were a few potatoes in. You were very lucky if you got one. I did. I was lucky. I got one small potato in with my red cabbage. So that was the roughest week I think we had. There were some Red Cross parcels arrived at the station. And they had a four-wheel trolley. And so anyone that could go and load the Red Cross parcels had to go down to the station with this trolley. And there was one chappie. He had had a remarkable incident where a bullet had gone in and smashed his jaw on the right-hand side and come out his left eye. Of course, he'd lost his eye, and his jaw had set up again, and the Germans were going to fix him up with a with a glass eye. And because it had brought the membranes out with it, the bullet as it came out, they'd given him a little triangle of glass to put in to start with, and hold the membranes back until they settled down, and then they would fit him with this glass eye. Well, he went down to the station in the snow and was pushing this barrow back, leaning pretty heavily on it, and he lost this piece of glass out of his eye, and he's on his hands and knees in the snow looking for his glass eye, which would make a good story in comic cuts, but I don't suppose he was very pleased. I thought mine was a remarkable case, to have a bullet go right through you and have no permanent damage from it. But there were some more remarkable cases than mine, but they'll no doubt have been recorded. I couldn't start to tell of them all. There were some cases in there. There was a Cockney, I do remember, who had two smashed arms. They'd plastered them both and then put them on a cage, and they looked like a sparrow trying to fly because his both arms, they were out, stretched one either side of him, and he was weeks and weeks like that. But every morning he came round, he wandered round the hospital, came in the door sideways, and was cheerful as any Cockney. Yeah. It was good to live with some of them, but not too good. Anyway, the doctors, of course, kept us there as long as ever they could. Kept telling the Germans when they came round inspecting and that there, as many tales as they could to keep us there instead of going out to work camp. But eventually they sorted us out. I was in there about 5 months, I think. And about 20 of us went off. And here we have a little bit of sympathy from the Germans. Of course, we were under the German army, not the Gestapo or SS or anything like that, the ordinary German army. Because we were all ex-wounded, they sent us to an off-lag to do light duties such as officers, batmen, orderlies, and light work of that nature.
Do you know which off-lag this was?
Off-lag 5A. At Weinsberg. About 100 kilometres south of Aalborg.
Heilbronn,
yeah. Hmm. Yeah.
Did you do work there for an officer?
No, I didn't. Four of us were picked to help a German Feldwebel who was a maintenance man. He repaired the wire if it got frayed, or a post in the wire, or a floorboard anywhere that became loose. And we went around helping him, and well, doing the work. He did the instructions. But we got on fairly well with him. We had trips out. We had to go out at times into the forest. Part of the Black Forest, I understand. Bringing in these trees, logs, pine trees. If a post in the wire had got rotten, we had to replace it with these trees. And we could almost cut this German on that it was heavy work and we wanted extra food, and he would go to the German quartermaster and he would come out with three or four loaves, and we would probably barter him for a tin of sardines we'd got out there. Because he stowed them away in a back pocket for tea on Sunday, I suppose, because they had very little at that time.
That was from a Red Cross parcel?
From a Red Cross parcel, yeah. Yeah. And so prison life went on. We'd I think we were far better off, as we were on light duties like that, than the poor officers. And I used to think they were day after day with nothing to do. It was most terribly monotonous life for them. We'd a mixed bunch, mainly South African, but we'd New Zealand and Australians, a Canadian, and so on. Then, by that time, they'd numerous musical instruments, and they could put a band show on or anything, play baseball, and all kinds of things. But and they always had plenty of cigarettes. Of course, I suppose their relatives were better off than ours, and they could send them more cigarettes. So I never ever had to ask anyone for cigarettes, but generally along as you did your work, some officer or another would say, "How are you for cigarettes?" Well, I had a stock answer for that. Well, I'm all right at the moment, but I shall soon be running short. And inevitably, they would roll up with 200 camels or sweet caprel or some, always in 200 packets, and so that set you going. Anyway, we soldiered on until one day we're out, and we had a German corporal in charge of us that day. And he whispered over to me. He could speak very little English, but "Cox, Cox, Swire Front, Morgan." Second front had occurred. Oh. So feel Luftruppen and all this, he was telling me. And we had to go back in the camp for some reason. And I sidled up to an officer I knew. His name's left me, but he had been a sergeant in my own regiment, Coldstream. Took a commission in some line regiment. And out of the corner of my mouth, I said, "Keep this." I said, "You'll have to tell everyone I know, but don't tell them where you get this information from." "What's that?" I said. "The second front started this morning." Well, this was an answer to the everybody's prayer. Like, off he went. Well, I think we were out another couple of hours at work, and I went into my barracut. Sat outside was a lieutenant of the Mauritius Army. Well, very few people could question him. But anyway, he stopped me and he said, "You brought some good news in." Me? I denied all knowledge. And I thought, that damned officer I told that to has gone and told everybody where he's got his information from. And anyway, this would-be Mauritius man, he got